Yes, hello everybody. In our IDBeat podcast series, Let's Talk, we come together today to speak about something very fascinating, the Sinai Trail. Sustainable hiking trails have become very popular in the last years, and there are several trails, especially also in the Middle East by now. I know about the very successful Jordan Trail, and I also heard about the Red Sea Mountain Trail and the Sinai Trail. And the good thing is that all these trails, they are really working with communities, the Bedouins, the people living in the villages along the trail. So these are really community-based, community trail tourism projects. And I'm very happy to have two very interesting people with me today who have either walked the trail, who have developed the trail, or both. So we have first Marinel de Jesus. She is actually the founder of Brown Gale Trekker and as well Equity Global Treks, two startups. And she's also founder of the Porter Boys Collective. And she also won with her team the IGB Social Entrepreneurship in Tourism competition last year with her colleagues from the Kushwigi English and Nomadic Culture Camp. And yeah, Marinel is a former lawyer. She is now really an activist and a passionate journalist and traveler and founder in sustainable tourism projects. And on the other side, I also am very happy to have with me Ben Hoffler, who is one of the founders of the Sinai and Red Sea Mountain Trail and also of the Sinai Trail, together with some local people who he will mention as well. And he's the author of the Sinai Trekking Guide. And I myself, well, a lot of people will hopefully already know me because I'm working very passionate for ITB and for the ITB corporate social responsibility and the emphasis on social responsibility, because I believe that as the largest travel trade show in the world, we really have to give back and we have a responsibility towards society as a whole. So I'm working constantly to bring sustainable thinking into mainstream tourism and responsible thinking, human rights, and yeah, to work for a better future, because tourism can be a tool for good. The Sinai Trail is Egypt's first long-distance hiking trail. It was launched already in 2015 as a 220-kilometer route, and that took 12 days, I think, to complete. And it was involving three Bedouin tribes. It was voted at that time as the best new tourism project. And Wanderlust and Outdoors magazines ranked it as one of the world's best new trails. And it was so successful that the Bedouin behind it didn't want to stop, but they continued developing the trail. So today, it is a 550-kilometer trail taking 54 days to complete, involving eight tribes already. So, Ben, you are a co-founder of that trail. Can you tell us how comes that you are doing what you're doing? You're living there, I understand now. So give us a little background of your own story.
Well, I am a geographer by training. So I've always had an interest in the outdoor world and the peoples of the outdoor world. When I finished university, I stayed in London and I was working in an office, and gradually I became quite disillusioned with doing this. So I wanted a change, and I ended up in Egypt for no particular reason other than I knew somebody in Cairo. When I was in Cairo, which is a big, bustling town, I felt a real need to escape, and the Sinai was the place that I escaped to. And the deeper that I went into the Sinai, the more that I came to love what was there, the mountains, the landscapes, the people, their old knowledge, skills, heritage that they would use to survive, travel, and thrive through that landscape. And I got pulled into this way of life quite unexpectedly. the deeper that I went.
Yeah. So can you share your experiences, how you started and how it worked to create the trail, and who inspired you, and also, yeah, where were the challenges?
The first thing that I did when I went to the Sinai was I wrote a trekking guidebook about the region. So that identified the best hiking routes through the mountains and deserts of South Sinai. These were all relatively short routes. This was about 10 years ago. And it was also about the time that long distance hiking trails in the Middle East were really getting some momentum and getting some traction. So if we looked over the Red Sea, we could see projects in the making like the Jordan Trail, which is a country length trail conceived by a guy called Tony Howard that runs the length of Jordan. There was another one called the Lebanon Mountain Trail, which was the first one in the region. And there was another one developing called the Palestinian Heritage Trail. So these were quite different concepts to what I had done in a guidebook, which was identifying shorter routes. It coincided with a very difficult time for the Sinai. So this was following the Egyptian Revolution. This was following unrest that happened in 2013. And it was following more unrest that was confined to the northern parts of the Sinai Peninsula, all of which had a disastrous impact, not just on Egyptian tourism, but specifically on Egyptian tourism within Sinai. So I saw the impact of this crash in tourism across the region. And I thought, how could we begin to, how could we create a project that would try and get this region back on its feet, provide jobs in areas where none existed, that could show a more accurate side of this region to the world, that could challenge conceptions about it being unsafe, and that could bring people together around one single thing rather than having them divided across individual projects that they were working on. The concept of a long distance hiking trail made a lot of sense. So we began.
And you met the right people.
I met the right people because I was connected to them through my guidebook. So I had already done quite a lot of groundwork in finding the best people to walk with. And more than that, really a kind of leader personality within each tribe that would be able to develop the routes, bring people on side, and tie it together. So I began working with people from three different tribes to begin with. One of them was called Masalem Abu Faraj from the Tarabin tribe. We had another guy called Faraj from the Mazena tribe. And then we had another guy also called Faraj from the Jebeleya tribe. And all of them took a very strong role in working to develop the route and then to bring those routes together into one single long distance hiking trail that would cross three different tribal territories. It was very important that when we created that trail, it was divided in a way that would be equal between each of those three tribes. It had to be 4 days crossing the lands of each tribe. So 4 days with the first one, 4 days with the second, and 4 days with the third. The way that it would work would be that people would go with each tribe through its own territory to the borders of the next, at which point.
And within the tribes, of course, they would have to talk to their elders and so on and see whether they were okay with it.
I mean, most of the people that were selected would to be those leaders were from the group that would be considered the elders of the tribe. These weren't young men. Okay. These were older people to begin with. So they had a lot of weight within their communities, and they had that ability to not just bring people on side within their own communities, but to cross those tribal divides and make things work across a tribally divided region. So certainly they had to definitely belong to a group of people that had the experience and the diplomatic skills to pull that kind of thing together. And all of those people are the co-founders of the project today.
Yeah, and I think the from the very beginning you were you took attention that it would really be owned, the project would really be owned by these communities. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So it's 100% Bedouin owned today. The Sinai Trail is managed by eight tribes today. So it expanded from a three tribe route into an eight tribe route in 2018. And all of the leaders of the eight Bedouin tribes came together and they sat together for a whole day talking about how everything would work, what the agreements would be between them. And they took an old Bedouin oath that they would work together and stand together until the sea is dry and hairs grow on the palms of our hands, which is to say forever. And that was quite a historic thing in the Sinai. The Sheikh of the Sinai Trail said that this was the first time in about 100 years that such an agreement had been made between the tribes to
Wow.
host traveling groups together. And those eight tribes today oversee the project and they manage it collectively. So there's a cooperative that owns it and there's a cooperative that will manage the direction of the trail and take decisions by majority on its direction for the future.
That sounds really good. But how do you manage, or how did you from the beginning, I think, also integrate that there is a minimum impact of hiking? I mean, because hiking in the desert, you have this question of water conservation, or what to do with litter and waste, and how did you face that?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, one of the things that I could say about waste is that the Bedouin, so when I say the Bedouin, it might be important for me to explain a little bit about what I mean when I say that. So the Bedouin are a people of, we could say, semi-nomadic pastoral heritage who trace their roots to the Arabian Peninsula. So these are people who came into the Sinai and came into other parts of the region that we call today the Middle East. And North Africa, if we include that in the Middle East. And they lived very close to nature. So they would move with their herds of goats and camels between pasture where the rain fell. And they would live in a close harmony with the natural world. So they didn't really produce much in the way of waste as we know it today. So things like plastic bottles and all these kind of things that a typical hiking group would produce today. So that was that, and it is, it's still one of the challenges that we've had is having a really good system to manage something unfamiliar that's produced in this area by the groups that the Bedouin are guiding for communities that historically haven't really produced it.
But normally, if they are in a homestay, I mean, they will just live like the nomads live or like the Bedouins live, so they would not produce any more waste than
Well,
them.
it doesn't really work like that. I mean, international hiking groups come with particular sets of demands. So, whereas, for example, the Bedouin would move and they would drink water from wells and so forth, when hiking groups come, they often demand bottled water and they need foods that have packaging and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's not like the Bedouin, sorry, the people who come on the hike will suddenly step into a world where none of this exists. It exists and it's brought into this world and it's even brought in by the Bedouin. Of course, they don't exist in a world today that looks the same as it did 50, 60, 100, 200 years ago. The world has changed, not just for the outside world, so settled world, but it's also changed for the Bedouins. So it's been something that we've had to think about a lot. And so as far as we can do this, we minimize any of the waste that's taken on to the trail in the first place. So we would strip packaging off the items. We would try and gather water from springs on the way where we can, where people are okay with that. We might purify that on the way. When it comes down to food, we might buy things from Bedouin communities on the way. So, for example, we might buy a goat, and the goat would be slaughtered and eaten on the trail itself. So, there's ways that we can try and minimize our impact on that, but It's something, of course, that we've got to pay great respect to. And a lot of the Bedouin as well take a leading role in doing that. They have always lived close to nature, and particularly the guides who work on the Sinai Trail take it very seriously, respecting their place, leaving the place in a good state for the others who'll follow, whether they're Bedouin or whether they're hikers and so forth. So,
I think that's interesting. It's also that the travelers who decide to do that, I mean, there is a growing demand for this kind of tourism. So these travelers are ready to follow the rules, I believe. Yeah,
they are. There's also a slightly different take. So a lot of the practices that we might see in the West aren't necessarily followed by the Bedouin either. So in the West, we might have a system that's a kind of zero impact as far as it can be. So leave no trace, don't leave anything behind, not even an apple peel or a banana skin or anything like that. It's a little bit different in the Sinai because the Bedouin would typically leave things like that on a rock, on a clean rock, rather than in the sand for the crows and the foxes and other animals to come and do along the way. So I don't see tourism projects, honestly, about bringing in a set of ideals that are developed in another place. I think it's important to also go with standards and customs that the Bedouin have as well. And so this is one thing that will be a little bit different as well in terms of the waste, but it's something at the front of what we do.
Okay. So to bring Marinelle back to bring her into the discussion, Marinelle, you have been on a hike recently. You did a 24-day hike, you told me. And you have also been interviewing the people over there, the Bedouins. So I would like to that you share a little bit with us your direct experiences. So first of all, maybe, how did you manage to walk 24 days?
So the 24 days is just 50% of the Sinai Trail. So I think we walk, I want to say about 200 kilometers or so in total. So on average, you know, I guess I have to convert to miles because I the American system that I'm used to, but it's probably about 10 to 12, 13 miles a day, which is, as a hiker, it's pretty doable when the terrain is mainly flat, especially for the first part of the trek. We were walking a lot more on the desert dunes and things like that, and not a lot of rock scrambling. But, you know, it's having said that, it's really not an easy thing to do for someone who's not experienced because it is 24 days. You're in a routine of waking up and hiking all day. It could be very hot sometimes. We also had some thunderstorms and rain, and actually even delayed one of our days, which made it kind of, you know, nerve-wracking because we were talking about the possibility of running into floods or getting stuck somewhere. So I highly advise someone who's really experienced with trekking to do it. It's not an easy feat to like just do 24 days in one go. But the easy part to it is that you're carrying a day pack and you carry essentials with you, which makes it really easy. The rest of the stuff that you have, they're carried by camels. So it's a supported trek, which makes it more bearable for a lot of people who are not inclined to carry heavy backpacks trekking over a number of days.
Does it end at the Red Sea?
No, actually it was from north to south. We ended in St. Catherine, not in the Red Sea, no.
Okay. So do you also, according to your experiences, what would be your experiences with the communities you met on the way? Were they very welcoming? Did you see that they were very happy to see you, especially maybe the women? I would also be interested in knowing the role of the women on the trail.
Yes, I actually spent time with the women, the Hamada tribe. They're the ones who want to become guides. There's a few of them, four or five that I met. I was hosted by a family and this woman who's the first female guide of Sinai Trail, Yasser. And I learned a little bit about their involvement in the industry. They're very hospitable, very kind. But I can tell they've had tourists in the past. It's not a place where you come in and they're sort of clueless about how to, host you. I can tell that they understand tourists and they know how to cater to them because they were pretty much ready to, prepare the meals and prepare the hike and whatever else you're looking for as a tourist. But the same thing can be said about the men. They're very welcoming. They're very excited to learn about other cultures. They love to engage in discussions. Hence, I was able to do a lot of interviewing while on the 24-day trek. They shared a lot about their culture. I mean, I think my impression, going back to your question about impression is that I want to say that before coming to Sinai Trail, I've been to so many treks, a lot of supported treks actually in Peru, Nepal, Bhutan, so many other places in the world. And I think one thing that distinguishes Sinai Trail from my view is that the Bedouins themselves are actually something to not take for granted. Like a lot of trekkers, they have this idea, I'm going to climb this peak, I'm going to complete the circuit because it's a goal. But I think it wouldn't be a complete experience without really getting to know the Bedouins and really having those conversations and being engaged in their community. I think the Bedouins themselves are the leaders on the trail, which I often do not see on other treks in other places that I've been.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I'm very, I'm very conscious of that because I've already had many experiences where the guides are the way they come across. They're giving me a service. I pay the money, and they give you the service. And this is the tourism industry that we see a lot. It's paying for a service. But with the Bedouins, it was different. It felt as if you're following their footsteps, but not only that, they're taking you to their world, the old and the new. And I don't want to romanticize it and say, oh, going to the Bedouin community is like getting into this old world and forgetting modernity and life. But Bedouins are part of the modern world too. And that's the fascinating part of it too. They're actually sort of hovering between two worlds, the new and the old. And how they navigate that, it's really fascinating to see because they still have that Bedouin identity, but at the same time, they're trying to deal with what's coming to them, which is the
Can
modernity of
you give
the.
us a practical example, maybe, of how you experience it?
I think the best way to say this is to share what the Bedouin has told me about the number one concern they have. They're concerned about the younger generation of Bedouins. They're concerned the older generation. For example, Nasser is the one of the leading the leaders of the trail. He actually led part of the trail, and he shared with us that, he's now training younger generation of guides because of the old and the new. There's a conflict, and there is this sort of kind of striving for the younger generation to continue on with the traditions of being a Bedouin. And so they're concerned about the future of the Sinai Trail because who's going to lead the trail when they're gone, when his generation is gone? So they're grappling with this idea of we got to sustain this. And this is part of sustainability, right? Because, and maybe this isn't something common like in the Inca Trail, because you know what? The Inca Trail, you can always hire service. You can hire porters, you can hire guides. It doesn't matter. But Sinai Trail is special in that way where the Bedouins really find it a real problem to pass on the generation. That question of who to pass it on is a real issue for them. And
So
the fact.
you also said you mentioned that there's also a female guide. I mean, this is something completely new, isn't it?
As far as I know, yes, it's a recent phenomenon. I know Yasser was, I think she might have started around 2019, but the pandemic hit, so that kind of interrupted the process for her to continue guiding. But she did share her views about the industry that she wanted to be more involved. They actually have done a lot more day hiking, I guess, in the past, and their hope is that they could have more women be involved in the industry, at least for their tribe, that part of the Sinai Trail, where they can actually actually do overnight, because they're, from their view, it's normal to be walking on the mountains because they herd goats. That they're nomadic. They were nomads. And so to them, hiking on the trail isn't so far of an idea from who they are. And the inclusion of the women is really definitely key, I think, in terms of sustainability of this trail. You know, I think as a woman myself, as a tourist hiking, I look for that kind of female viewpoint because, you know, definitely what Nasser has shared is so, you know, instrumental in learning about the trail, but also to have a female viewpoint adds a more completeness to the experience as far as I'm concerned. So okay. For women to be part of that trail, if we're going to talk about passing on the wisdom and the knowledge and the culture, I think we have to include women in passing this on to them as well. So young generation of Bedouins plus the women, that could be the future of Sinai Trail, right? To continue forth with sharing the traditions in a complete way, in a manner where it's inclusive.
Well, that's very interesting. Ben, would you agree?
With what specifically?
With the situation that this might be the future for the Bedouins also to include women closer in the hiking.
Well, I
in terms of hiking, because that's the process of gender equality is always very complex, of course.
Yeah, it is very complex, and I guess it will vary a lot between European societies and Middle Eastern societies, and possibly as well between settled Middle Eastern societies and nomadic societies. So, in a Bedouin society, until we did this on the Sinai Trail, we definitely saw a very clear distinction between the roles of men and women in a Bedouin society. And it's accurate to say that in terms of tourism and in terms of women guiding, their participation in so far as I ever saw in the Sinai, and this was before we created the Sinai Trail, was absolutely minimal and largely invisible. So what we did with the Hamada tribe, that's the tribe to which Umyasa belongs, was really take a step out of these conventions, these very strong centuries-old traditions, and help Umyasa get to a point where she could do what she wanted, and hopefully she could inspire other people to do the same thing. I would say that in my experience of working in the Sinai, it's hard to quantify it, but I would say probably 90 to 95% framed by my interactions with men. So as a man creating the Sinai Trail with other men, my access to women, speaking with women, walking with women was absolutely minimal. This was a very unique thing that happened with Umyasa, and it happened with a very supportive and open-minded husband called Ibrahim Abu Yasa. And it also happened with the support of other people in the community, but it didn't happen easily.
But sometimes these examples are really like door openers, you know. Tourism can open doors. In a soft way, you know.
It can.
Because they're always the first.
It can do. I mean, I think it's a little bit too early to say whether that will happen on the Sinai Trail, because as Marinel said, Omiyasa's ascent to being a head guide on the Sinai Trail coincided with the pandemic, which shut tourism down. But she's taken a very big step forward. She works with three other women guides in her region. She is a unique personality. She's an extraordinary woman. I've never met anybody like her. She's very courageous. She's very single-minded. She's stubborn in the best possible way a person could ever be stubborn. Walking with her opened my eyes to a different Sinai. So I saw that the women had a different relationship with the land to the men, which was very interesting to me. I found it very interesting to see how women interacted with other women when they would meet them in the mountains. If I was walking with a man, we would pass a long way away and we wouldn't be able to see them. So it opened a door to a more female side of the Sinai when I was there. And it opened my eyes, honestly, to seeing this region just through a totally different lens that's been framed by a different set of constraints. And that, to me, was an education. It was something that revealed a lot of things to me that I wish I had seen and known before. So I would say it's a very valuable thing. I hope that it continues. To get there took a lot of negotiation with the community. So we had to frame her role within a way that was acceptable and that would be safe for her as well. Remember, because when individuals will step outside the norms of their society, there's always risk that comes with that, a kind of, ostracism from these social structures that they belong to. In the Sinai, there's this concept of honor, which is really tied up with your reputation. And I guess it probably the best way to describe it is how closely you conform to the socially accepted norms within that society. So in stepping outside and becoming a woman guide, roaming quite freely, walking with men, that is very different to what women have done before.
So yeah, I think it's extremely interesting what you're saying, especially also experiences that you saw everything through a different eye. I mean, as you said, also local wildlife, everything.
I want to say as well that, I mean, this kind of thing, it's got to be done very sensitively because these are individuals with places and communities. The consequences of stepping outside your social norms are that your name can be damaged. What that means effectively is that you'll get less opportunities than you did before. Your relationships might change. So we've got to be realistic in how far we can push this and taking it one step at a time in the most sensitive way. So that's what we did with Omyasa. Now, it's important to say as well that it didn't come without pushback. So on the eve of the very first hike that we did with women, so that was Omyasa leading plus three women guides with her, a lot of pressure came to the women from people within the community. And what that meant was that a lot of the women, except Omyasa, so the three other women, would not want to be photographed at all or their identities to be known. So when they walked, they would wrap their headscarves completely around their face, covering their eyes as well. Omyasa was different in that respect. So it comes with an amount of talking. There's been pushback on Omyasa since she became a guide. Rumors have been started. Difficulties have come her way. So it's important for all of us who work in tourism and who by default say this is a good thing, which I believe it is, to also be realistic and know how far we can push it and how important it is to be sensitive about it. At the same time, it hasn't been taken up by other tribes. So we've tried to bring women guides in and a number of the other tribes, particularly the ones that are more used to tourism in the region, but it hasn't been supported. So there are clearly barriers that still exist in a strong way. Despite the good that it could do economically or in any other way to women being guides on the Sinai Trail. And I would say that's just a remarkable salute to Omyasa and how unique and strong she was to do that.
No, but I think it's a very important discussion which we're having here now because in all parts of the world, people are, I mean, we as tourism practitioners, we're discussing how to help human rights, how to bring gender equality forward also through tourism. But as you mentioned, it's so important to be sensitive and not to destroy any existing knots in the communities. But yeah, but they're always front runners. Us and people who are breaking the line for others to follow. So it's very interesting. I also wanted to know a little bit more about you mentioned already during the crisis, everything was down, but was there any kind of resilience in that region? How did you experience it especially with your tourism model?
Well, we've got a very big differential at the Sinai Trail to other trails in the Middle East. trails like the Lebanon Mountain Trail, the Jordan Trail, the Palestinian Heritage Trail are able to receive, and they have been able to receive since their inception, millions of dollars of funding from well-known international organizations like the World Bank or USAID. We can't get any of that at the Sinai Trail because it's essentially not permitted in Egypt. So that puts us in a position that's especially vulnerable to a collapse in tourism. Within the Bedouin community, there's always been a natural resilience, as you would expect for a people who've chosen to live in such a harsh environment over so many centuries, as opposed to settling down into an easier life. One of the ways that they've done it is by diversifying their economy. So alongside tourism, they will have a number of other things that that they might do. So tourism essentially shut down in the pandemic more than anything that we had ever seen. Tourism, as I said at the beginning, has been through a number of disasters in Egypt that have put it down to a trickle in the Sinai, but the pandemic stopped it completely in its tracks. So at that time, it was really just about keeping it ticking over as best as we can through voluntary efforts. We have a good community of people around us who can help with key things. And it was about the Bedouin falling back on sometimes older ways of life, sometimes other sectors in the economy, until the time that tourism returned and we could begin to work again. It's definitely picked up quite significantly in the last 8 months. I think that since the lockdowns, there's probably been a huge appetite for people just to escape. And I think walking is one of the best possible ways that people can find to escape, just being out in the wide open spaces. So I think the trails have come back. They survived just, it wasn't easy, but they just survived. And now they're slowly picking up again. That was a big challenge, but we got through it.
Yeah. I think that's really also something for the future, that these trails will still see a growing demand, because the whole tourism trend is towards more private experiences. So I want to hear a little bit more about the beauty and maybe the experience of the landscape and what makes it especially fascinating. Marina, can you give us a little picture of the beauty?
Well, I you know, it's funny because when I'm not a kind of person, a trekker who does a lot of desert trekking, to be honest. So I usually climb alpine mountains and peaks with snow on them. So I was at first not really sure what I was getting myself into with hiking Sinai Trail for 24 days. And but I was really pleasantly surprised. It had a lot of variety. You start out, in the desert area, from the north going towards the south. As you go further south, the mountains get bigger and higher, and you do more rock climbing or scrambling over them, non-technical. And the challenge is different every day, and the scenery is different every day. It never gets old. So my first concern was, will the view be the same every single day? It turns out that wasn't the case. And there's beautiful canyons. I think that actually that's one of the best parts for me, was seeing the canyons, because they were different colors every single time, different features, different looks, different different variety of them that I didn't realize there could be so much diversity with canyons. But also even the sand itself is different every single day, So what sounds to be mundane turns out to be unique in a lot of ways if you just, give it the time and the effort to walk through them. And there are even pools like water along the way, which was fascinating, because I actually thought it would be super dry, that we'll hardly be able to wash, hands or face or whatever. And there were actually a few pools along the way too. And some of them are really beautiful. You can even try to dip in there, a little bit, and things like that, especially when it's hot, it's perfect. And then you have the high peaks closer to St. Catherine, which I love. You get to peak. You get to climb the highest peak in Egypt, St. Catherine. So the views are spectacular on top, and there's sunset and sunrise views as well, which to me was phenomenal. So, you know, having said that, there's also the plants along the way that you can learn about, which is really interesting. And then a lot of different stories from the Bedouin culture about their lives. You know, I learned about how men and women meet and date. I learned about marriage. I learned about the different Bedouin laws, and so on and so forth. So all of that experience to me was just, you know, it was just like an assault to all the senses. And, you know, of course, as a hiker, I was really happy that I hiked that many miles and finished in 24 days. I wanted to actually do the whole thing, but, you know, that wasn't viable at that time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that sounds good. I would really like to do it when I hear that, you know. So you have the stories, to have the local wildlife, to see the beauty of the Kenyans, and then it's a different, really a different kind of tourism, and it helps you slow down, I think, you know. So would you say it's a role model for similar kinds of projects and in other parts of the world?
Yes, I was very cautious coming into Sinai Trail because I've been to so many trails and I've seen how tourism works in these places. And like I said, a lot of them have this service orientation to them where someone pays and you give them service, and that's the relationship you have with the local people. And that really is frustrating for me because as a Filipina, you know, I really feel like every place in the world can offer so much more than just service. You can offer so much more of who you are, your culture. You can forge human connections in a lot of different ways beyond service. And so when I came to Sinai, I didn't really have so much of a high expectation because I didn't want to be disappointed. But in fact, I was really fascinated with it. And I actually realized, wow, this is just a different kind of model of tourism. And when I talked to the Bedouins, I learned that it is them who's leading it. They have the say, they have. And I think what's fascinating about it to me is that from day one, they seem to have the say about the project. They were already involved in it. They were leading it. It was their idea. There was ownership. When I look at Inca Trail in Nepal, you know, Himalayan treks, in Kilimanjaro Trail, the idea did not come from the local people. Their voices were not the starting point of the conversation. I love the fact that Ben engaged in conversations with them. And I can imagine how those conversations go because I do that in my work as well. That's a ton of conversation because you gotta bridge those, you know, the cultural gap, right? As an outsider and then the local people. We need to kind of learn from this project the value of local ownership of tourism projects. Why it's powerful and why it should continue. So I honestly advocate for Sinai Trail as one of the best models to look at. So if people ever have the chance to like remodel their projects, that they should look into something like this. And I have my Mongolia project. So I sometimes consult with Ben about it because definitely he left footprint and he left the sort of the model that we can all follow.
No, that is good. Ben, it must be good to hear that, is it?
Yeah, Marinelle is a critical thinker. She takes critical thinking from her work as a prosecutor into everything she does with tourism. So I know she always gives honest and authentic feedback, which is the most valuable kind. In terms of my take on the model of the Sinai Trail and Red Sea Mountain Trail, I would simply say that, yes, of course, local ownership is the way forward, creating that kind of equality where the local people of the place speak about it in their own voice will add a huge amount to it. And that will create the space that's very valuable as an interaction, not just for the hiker who's coming, but also for the Bedouin guides. It's just a valuable space of interaction for both. So in that sense, yes. I would guess it's a good model to follow. If I went to a completely different place, such as Mongolia or anywhere else, then I would also add that every place needs its own model, and creating any project that is successful, like the Sinai Trail or Red Sea Mountain Trail, relies on a deep understanding of the place and a lot of research and integrating the structures that work in that place into everything you do, rather than taking a set of values from outside and imposing those on a place. So it has to be grown organically. These projects honestly usually start best from the grassroots up. So with a conversation and a cup of tea, and just with a lot of listening and conversation. And so that would be my model. Just start at the grassroots and make sure that all the way through you're listening to whoever you're talking to in their place.
Oh, wonderful, Ben. Yeah, very good set. And to be sensitive is so important. That's great. So we are running out of time. And I just wanted to ask you whether you have your expectations for the future for general, sustainable, responsible tourism, or for your own project. So what is your wish for the future?
I just wish that the trails continue to grow, that they continue to make a positive impact for me. There are a number of positive impacts. There's an economic one. So that's about creating jobs in a place where they don't exist, but it's about creating the right kind of jobs. So jobs that give people the right position in their place and that allow them to talk in their own voice and share the soul of that place with the person they're with. I hope that the Sinai Trail and the Red Sea Mountain Trail will underline the beauty of a culture that is today endangered. So a lot of its traditional skills and knowledge and wisdom is disappearing as people leave the desert and settle down in the towns. So I hope that it will underline that, and it will remind people that we need to talk about it and think about ways that that can be conserved as a very precious piece of heritage that belongs to all of humanity for the future.
Thank you, Ben. So, Marina.
Well, I think I would speak broadly in terms of just my hope for the tourism industry is that we elevate the voices that are not still being 100% heard and valued. I think when it comes to gender equity, I don't even see gender equity as really a gender issue. It's a human issue. It's a human rights issue, actually, not just a female male. And if we steer away from that, I think we're better off. We'll make progress. And what I mean by this is I've always been asked what women empowerment is, what it means. And to me, it's simple. Being full as yourself, like being yourself 100% and living your full, the full version of you is really what women empowerment is. That means if a woman wants to be a guide and has that desire and has the skill, why not open that door? Because that makes her whole, right? So for women, I think it's just all about freedom, the freedom to be themselves and nothing more, really. So it isn't about men against females, vice versa. It isn't about, you know, creating sort of a disparity or any kind of tension between anybody or even, you know, the culture argument. You know, we can definitely dissect that for the future, but I think we need to see a lot more inclusion. And I'm seeing a lot more community also raising their voices, which is great. And I think that's also something that we have to value for the future in terms of tourism. How would tourism look like and how would the experience be different if we are coming in as tourists and as guests instead of someone who's a consumer? We should think about invitation when we come to these places. We should think about the roles of the local people as the host, not just the people who are providing you service. Because if we do that, then there would be a much more meaningful way of truly traveling and creating a transformational experience, not just for the tourists, but also for the local people themselves, so they can be fully who they are and share who they are in a way that's very raw and honest. So that's really my big, you know, goal for the future. I hope, you know, we can slowly get into that point where it isn't all about just profiting and, you know, basically extracting, that we're going to go back to the basics and redo everything we know about the tourism industry to make it better.
So very well said, Marinelle. Thank you so much. And I think that's really what we have to work for, and I'm sure that we will have other opportunities to discuss that again. So I'm very grateful for you, Marunel, and I'm also grateful for you, Ben. I think it was an excellent podcast, and I really enjoyed every minute of it, and I hope our auditorium will feel the same. So thank you so much, and let's stay tuned. Thank you.